Today on Blue 58, let's talk numbers for a second, specifically how to make sense of stats that look weird, starting with one of our own. Then we introduce a brand new metric to the lineup at the Power Sweep. Finally, Mark Murphy made a comment about the NFL schedule that we can't let slip by.
Blue 58!
Hello and welcome to another episode of Blue 58, the one and only podcast to thepowersweep.com. I am your host, John Meerdink. Happy to be with you here for another episode. If you were listening to our last program, you might remember that I said we were going to do some alternate history stuff this week because I was going to be out handling some personal stuff for the next couple episodes. But that stuff has been wrapped up and we're back in the saddle here. So there's going to be one alternate history style episode later this week, and then we'll be into the regular season. Well, not regular season, training camp starting next week, and we'll be talking more about the stuff that's actually happening on the field in Green Bay as a result. So we'll save that second topic for later on. We'll talk about one of the things we'd plan to do later this week instead. So that's what's coming up. I am excited to be back with you here, and I'm especially excited because on this episode of Blue 58, we get to add a new person to our lineup. I am introducing today a brand new co-host at the Power Sweep. I'm really excited about this. I think he's going to bring a lot to the show. So without further ado, here are the opening comments from my new co-host. Take it away. See, that's the problem, though. I tried to get some comments on tape from this new co-host of mine, and there's an issue. He's only 5 days old, and he doesn't know how to talk yet. And the things that I could get on tape from him, he really didn't, I don't think, articulate the things that he was trying to say very well. So it might be a little bit confusing. I thought better to just leave it out. This is all a very confusing way of saying that we have a new member in our family, my actual family. My wife and I welcomed our first child last week on Thursday, 7-11, and I am very excited, smiling very wide, just talking about it. He is a joy to be around, and it's exciting to have him as a part of our family. I'm very tired. It's been a busy few days here, and this episode's probably going to be a little bit shorter as a result. It's been a bit busy. Both mom and baby are doing great, and we're excited to have him as part of the team. But if you hear a little bit of noise in the background, or if I have to make an unnatural sounding edit point here, that's why. And I'll be sure to clue you in there. It could be another 200-400 episodes before he's really ready to contribute, but I'm confident he'll get there someday. Let's talk real quick about some numbers. Last week on the show, we talked about a new stat that I'm working on as part of our advanced stats lineup. First and foremost, I think we're going to go with a different name for advanced stats. I think I'm just going to call them custom stats from now on. I don't know if they're advanced or not, and I don't know if I like that advanced metrics description anyway. So let's just call them custom metrics. It's stats that only we're looking at, and quite frankly, they may only be of interest to me, but I think they aid in my understanding of the game, and hopefully they'll be an assistance of assistance to you as well. Last week, we talked about a new stat that I'm working on called adjusted yards per target, kind of based on that adjusted net yards per attempt stat that seems to be a really good indicator for overall passing success. Basically, this number seeks to contextualize a player's overall receiving game contribution. So not just yards and catches, but how many yards and touchdowns a guy is producing, in addition to how often his passes or passes thrown his way are intercepted versus the amount of times that the ball is thrown his way. That's a really kind of complex way of describing what essentially boils down to yards per target plus a little bit extra. We got some good feedback on that, and I would like to work through that with you here a little bit. Mike reaches out via email and says, "Good morning, John. I just got your latest episode and heard your preliminary work on your new receiver stat. I'm certain you see how Geronimo Allison's stat is weird relative to Davante Adams. The obvious one is how little Allison plays. There a way to adjust for games played or for actual time on the field? I'm not sure how to put it, but I'm sure you get my point. Clearly, Adams was more impactful for better or worse over the course of the season. talking further, he says Jamon Moore and MVS may have had the same number, or Morse could be better, just pulling numbers out of a hat, but does that reflect real contributions? Anyway, love the show. Keep it up. Mike. Mike, do appreciate you reaching out, and you are absolutely correct. There are some shortcomings in this stat and kind of all stats like this. Numbers called rate stats. Number per another number. So miles per hour, driving along in your car, that's a rate stat. You're driving so many miles in a given hour. And that's not always the best way to look at somebody's performance, because it takes away, it doesn't contextualize how often they're actually getting involved with things. So you might be able to say, to run, say, 15 miles an hour in a flat-out sprint. But that hardly matters, because we all understand that you're only doing that for a few seconds at a time. Usain Bolt might be as fast as a car over 100 yards, but everybody understands that that 30-mile-an-hour sprint that he's doing is only for 100 yards. He's only doing that for 9-point-whatever seconds at a time. That's the problem we run into with stats like this. And as Mike asks, I'm not sure there's a way around it. If there is, I'm not really sure what that would be. I think the best way to look at numbers like this is to look at some of the baseline numbers, the numbers you're putting in to get that, and try to keep in mind that they may screw things up a little bit. So speaking about this number in particular, Geronimo Allison caught or had 30 targets in his brief run last year, had 303 yards worth of catches, and had two touchdowns. None of the passes thrown towards him were intercepted. And as a result, his adjusted yards per target number is 11.43. Really, really good. That was better than Julio Jones, Antonio Brown, DeAndre Hopkins, Adam Thielen, even Davante Adams last year. Adams, for his part, was targeted 169 times, produced 1,386 yards and 13 touchdowns. He, too, did not have any passes thrown his direction intercepted. That's good for an overall adjusted yards per target number of 9.74. So, not quite as good as Allison's, but he had the ball thrown his way a lot more. So why is Allison's number so much bigger, and why is that a problem? Well, a couple of reasons. First, as Mike says, he didn't play all that much last year. He was banged up and only had 30 passes thrown his way. You also have to keep in mind that both of Allison's touchdowns were big, big plays. I think his catch against the Bears was 36 yards or something like that, almost 40 yards, 36 or 39. Suppose I could look it up. I don't know. No way of knowing, though. There's no sort of worldwide accessible device that will help you find easily accessible numbers or things like that. So I guess we're just never going to find out. But the one against the Washington Redskins was 64 yards. So there's about 100 yards and two touchdowns on just two targets. That's not really a good overall reflection of his rate for the year. That does factor into this yards per target number that we're working on, but that's not, as Mike points out, necessarily the best measure of his overall contributions. So I think the best way to do something like this is to have some kind of cutoff number, an amount of targets that you have to get to before you really start looking at these numbers as carrying any kind of weight. When we talked last week, I cut things off at 30 targets because that got you the top eight guys in the Packers last year. But if you bump it up to 60 targets, you only have four guys to talk about, but you're probably getting a little bit better look at those rate stats anyway. For instance, let's look at the number two and three guys on the Packers last year in terms of targets, Jimmy Graham and Marquez Valdes-Scantling. Graham was targeted with 90 passes last year, caught two touchdowns and had two passes thrown his way intercepted. His adjusted yards per target number is 6.51. MVS, though, had 18 fewer targets, but produced 581 yards and two touchdowns. No interceptions on passes thrown his way. So his yards per target number was 8.63. I think those two are close enough in overall targets that their numbers are similar. And what that tells me is Marquez Valdes-Scantling should probably have been a lot more involved in the offense than he was last year. Or, alternatively, the Packers should have been just throwing the ball to anybody other than Jimmy Graham last year because 6.51 yards per target is not super great. In fact, it's the third worst number among players who had at least 30 targets last year on the Packers. Not great. That's what I'm trying to get at with this number. And as Mike says, we've got to keep in mind some of the underlying information that goes into stats like this. And that's a good thing to keep in mind as you look at stats overall. So thanks, Mike, for that that feedback. And we will always, when we bring this stuff up, try to fill that number in a little bit more fully as to what exactly it means. Let's talk about another stat that we're working on. And this one is one I put a fairly significant amount of time in so far this offseason. I've been trying to come up with a way to contextualize line play. There aren't a lot of good stats on offensive line performance. And the ones that we do have are kind of black box stats. There's stats where you don't really know where the numbers came from. That would be something like a Pro Football Focus rating. They've done a lot more lately on explaining why that they rate the way they do, what their numbers mean, so on and so forth, and that's good. But still, unfortunately, we just have to take their word on why one guy is rated at an 89.6 and another guy is a 91.3. They talk about their process. They don't really ever talk about their data. And to my knowledge, there isn't really a stat out there that can contextualize the individual performance of a single offensive lineman. I'm not sure this is that number either, but it's the best thing I've been able to think of. And it could be something that helps us paint a little bit more of a picture on individual offensive line performance. I'm calling it penalties and sacks per starter snaps. Or if you want to do an acronym, PASS. We're dropping the second P in there. So we have penalties, P, and A, sacks, S, per, no P, starter snaps, P-A-S-S-S, PASS. What is this stat? Basically, I want to track negative plays for an offensive lineman. There's not really a good way, as far as I can tell, without watching every single snap and trying to grade the outcome, and then sharing the data that you accumulated over that time to measure an offensive lineman's individual positive performances or even his negative performances to that extent. But we do have two pieces of data that we can track that might help us come up with a way to measure an individual lineman's performance. There are ways that we can get a guy's penalties and his sack totals. Stats Incorporated tracks both of those numbers. A couple other sites do penalties, but Stats in particular tracks sacks allowed. They assign every sack given up by a team to an individual player, down to half sacks even. And I figure, given the impact that a sack can have on an offensive drive, it's good to track that outcome in particular on a snap-by-snap basis for an individual player. I think it's also worthwhile to track how many penalties a guy is drawing or committing, because those two, especially holds, can have a big impact on your team's offensive performance. How often have you seen a drive absolutely derailed by a holding penalty? Gotta avoid those however you can. And if you've got guys on the field who are giving up large amounts of penalties in those areas, that's going to be a problem for you in the long term. So, how does this number work? I've taken those that information from the Washington Post, which publishes the Stats Inc. data on each of these guys individually, and I've divided it by the amount of snaps a guy's played. But here's the important part. We don't want this to just be a rate stat, because a guy could either be way off or could be off one way or another, just based on the amount of snaps that he plays really easily. Plus, we're also going to get a super, super small number to play with if we just do a rate stat. So, for instance, David Bakhtiari had 4 penalties last year and gave up 3 sacks. But dividing that by 1,031 snaps that he played last year is going to yield to a number so small that it really is hard to put it into any kind of context. So what do we do? I think you have to normalize it to some standard. And the number I've come up with to use for normalization is 65. 65 snaps per game. That's about how often a typical starting lineman should be on the field in an NFL game. The average snaps per game in an NFL game can vary widely, but based on the numbers I've looked at a couple different sources, 65 seems to be a pretty good number for an offensive lineman to play over the course of a season. If you played 65 snaps per game in 16 games a year, you'd play 1,040 snaps per year. So that's a little bit more than Bakhtiari would have played last year. He played about 96% of the Packers snaps. And that seems like we're in the ballpark there with 65 snaps per game, using that to normalize the figure. So we've got penalties and sacks, per starter snaps. We're looking at how often, if a guy was in the starting lineup, how many penalties and sacks together would he be committing in an individual game. Does that make sense? Good. Let's talk about the actual results here. So what does this mean for how the Packers did last year? Well, I looked at six Packers offensive linemen, starting just with guys who gave up sacks in 2018. Actually, five offensive linemen from last year and one who played elsewhere in 2018, Billy Turner. So we're trying to get an idea who is out and about for the Packers last year on the offensive line and what their contributions to the team could mean within this stat. And this is a stat that's going to grow a little bit over the course of the season as we get more data. And I think it's also going to help us chart player performance over time. We'll circle back to that. The five players I looked at from the Packers, plus Billy Turner, are Jason Spriggs, Brian Bulaga, Justin McCray, Lane Taylor, David Bakhtiari, and Billy Turner. Corey Linsley didn't give up a penalty last year, didn't commit a penalty last year, so it would just be sacks per 65 for him. That didn't seem super interesting, so we're not going to waste a whole lot of time on it. Jason Spriggs on the Packers was the worst in this stat last year. Per 65 snaps, he was giving up just over two combined penalties and sacks. So every game, you can expect Jason Spriggs' name to be called twice for negative plays. As you might imagine, David Bakhtiari was the best among these guys. He committed four penalties and gave up three sacks last year in just over 1,000 snaps. So his per 65 rate was 0.44, less than once every two games. He's going to have his name called negatively. And as I've looked into this number a little bit more, it seems like that 0.5 figure is pretty well elite. That's about what you'd be looking for from an elite lineman. Basically, what you want from an elite level lineman is his name getting called for a negative reason, basically once every two games. And putting that in context of his career, David Bakhtiari has been at an elite level for three seasons now. Each of the past 3 years, he's been under that 0.5 sacks and penalties per 65. He peaked back in 2015 with 1.16, but ever since then, it's just been edging down slowly, and he's been doing very, very well. Elsewhere in that range between Spriggs and Bakhtiari, we have Lane Taylor, who gave up 0.62 penalties and sacks per 65 last year. And for Taylor, that's been a pretty good season, but not as good as he has been. Among other Packers offensive linemen, that was very solid, but for Taylor, that's the worst he's been in the last couple of years. That's up from 0.35 and 0.21 in 2016 and 2017, respectively. And Taylor was a little bit banged up last year, and this shows how his performance suffered last year as a result. Finally, let's talk about Brian Bulaga. Bulaga's career low came back in 2016 with a 0.52 penalties and sacks per 65, but it's been edging up each year since then. He only played 232 snaps in 2017, so we're not going to ding him too much there for a jump, but he was up to 781 last year, and he was up to almost 0.92, almost to the one per game of a sack or a penalty level. Not super great, but still still pretty solid. He's hanging in there all right. This is going to be an interesting stat, I think, to track year over year. And it'll give us an idea where guys are trending one way or another as they play further into their NFL career. It also could be a good way, I think, going forward to talk about potential free agent targets that the Packers may be interested in. Guys who are not doing a whole lot or are playing a significant amount of snaps but aren't being called for negative plays all that often. That would be worth keeping an eye on. It also should be noted that there are a lot of things that this stat doesn't account for. Scheme, for one thing. It's tough to put into this stat exactly what teams are asking guys to do. David Bakhtiari is a good example of that. You look way back at his 2013 numbers. He gave up 7.5 sacks and was penalized 8 times. That's not great, but if you think back to what the Packers' offensive line was like in 2013, he was basically out on an island as a rookie from day one. There you go, kid. Figure it out. You're an NFL player now. You're starting for Brian Bulaga, who tore up his ACL on family night. Figure it out. And, oh, by the way, you're going to be playing against Alden Smith in the season opener. That's a trial by fire, and his numbers suffered as a result. This stat doesn't really account for that. It also doesn't necessarily do a good job of differentiating between guards and tackles and centers. Different things are asked of those different guys. I realize all that, and we'll try to keep that in mind as we go deeper and deeper into the numbers on this stat. It should give us an idea about how guys are playing within the context of their team, though, and how they're doing within the course of their career. Are they getting better? Are they getting worse? Are they staying the same? All stuff that's worth noting. Let's round it out by talking real quick about Billy Turner. Last year, he was penalized twice and gave up 3.5 sacks on 824 snaps. That works out to a per 65 rate of 0.43. Just slightly better than David Bakhtiari. Again, different positions, but something to keep an eye on. Now for something completely different. Real quick, then we'll be done for tonight. Thank you very much for listening for this first episode in this new era of my life individually. Fun stuff. Mark Murphy commented recently on, I think, what is the preliminary shot in what could be an interesting labor battle as the Packers and the rest of the league go through this new collective bargaining agreement process. Quoted in The Athletic, Mark Murphy kind of poo-pooed the NFL's proposition to the NFLPA that they move to an 18-game schedule. Let's read what The Athletic had to say about this and what Mark Murphy said got their interest and my interest as a result. Quote, commenting on a Wall Street Journal report Thursday that the league was pushing a scenario of an 18-game season where players would only play 16 of those contests, Murphy said, quoting Murphy here, quite honestly, that is a hard sell to fans, end quote. Instead, he proposed a 17-game season with the extra game as a neutral site and one less preseason game. Murphy now speaks extendedly here. We're looking at the overall structure of the season, and quite honestly, our preseason is not very good. I would be very concerned about the health and safety aspects of adding two regular season games. And so I think that there's a number of things we're looking at. I think also the possibility of expanding the playoffs, I think that should be a positive. That could be a positive for the league. And the other is the international aspect. There's some things that we can do in the season structure that would allow us to play more games at neutral sites, either internationally or non-NFL cities, that would help us grow the game, end quote. First, some overall thoughts. I'm against expanding the schedule. I understand the arguments for it. It would be more revenue for the NFL. Probably getting rid of preseason games. If guys are going to get hurt, they might as well get hurt in games that matter. I get all that. I think the schedule is fine how it is. But this also, I recognize, could be inevitable. The lure of money is very, very strong. And it could be, I think, inevitable in the way that Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, described ads on NBA jerseys repeatedly as being inevitable. They're not inevitable. They weren't inevitable. They didn't have to put ads on jerseys. But Silver just said it again and 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 again. And people finally accepted the idea of ads on jerseys because he kept saying that it was going to happen, even though it didn't have to happen. David Stern, his predecessor, says, over my dead body, that's never going to happen. We were never going to put ads on jerseys. For him, it was not inevitable. But Silver decided it was, and it ultimately worked out to be. This might be the way of schedule expansion in the NFL. It may be inevitable in that way. And if the schedule expands, I think this might be the most interesting and perhaps best way to do it. 18 games seems like too many, but if you do 17 regular season games and get rid of one preseason game, that might not be too bad. And if you play that 17th game at a neutral site, that adds something interesting both for fans watching at home and fans in potential new cities. You wouldn't ever have to give up a home game anymore either to do those London games. That could probably be part of it. And on top of that, you could probably get really creative with what you do with these neutral site games. The NFL would probably brand these games some way, and if you do it that way, you've got some cool possibilities. I think it could end up being like the equivalent, the NFL equivalent of non-championship bowl games. So you've got the Poinsettia Bowl, the Motor City Bowl, whatever, Alamo Bowl, games that aren't necessarily tied to anything that means anything, but they're fun experiences nonetheless. The NFL would have the added upside of having games that actually mean something here. So how would these NFL bowl games work? I think you've got a few different categories, like international stuff, rotating games, college stadium games, and big games in non-NFL cities. The international stuff is easy. You've got a London series of games. That's obvious. They've been doing that already. But what about a series of games or a game every year in Mexico? They've tried that a couple times in preseason and stuff. It's a mixed results, but I think that's a city they look at pretty consistently. And why wouldn't you? Mexico City is enormous. What about an Asia series, Japan or China? You could do the same thing that you do in London or Mexico, but do it in Japan or China. Both markets that the NFL has expressed interest in exploring before. Or if you want to stick with Europe, why not Germany? American football is pretty popular there. There's some significant NFL Europe roots there, World League football. That's an opportunity there. You could expand. Those could be some neutral sites and a way to expand the game internationally. If you stick at home, you could do like a series of games at neutral sites that change over time. For instance, like the historical rival series. You could have teams that played each other a bunch way back in the day, but don't so much anymore because of a realignment, relocation, things like that. One that jumped out to me right off the bat as someone who could be in that historical rival series, at least for a year, maybe not every year, but the Packers and Buccaneers, two old NFC Central rivals that had some pretty heated games in the late 90s and early 2000s, a lot of Brett Favre versus Warren Sapp type stuff that we really don't get to see anymore. Some deep history there that's kind of gone by the wayside. Playing that at a neutral site in Florida could be pretty cool. You could also have like a pre-relocation series of games. You could have somebody like the Indianapolis Colts play as the home team in somewhere near Baltimore or something like that. Maybe not, though. That could be some bad PR, a bit of a bad look there for the NFL. That was not the most well-received move in league history. Something that could be a little bit more popular, though, is like college stadium games. You have college teams play their games in NFL stadiums from time to time. Dallas Cowboys host games like that a lot. Lambeau Field does, too. What about in big college towns without NFL teams? There's some big stadiums out there that are empty on Sunday. I'm thinking of like the Big House in Ann Arbor, Omaha, Tallahassee, pretty much any SEC town, you could do some cool stuff there. And then you got the option of playing like big NFL or big games in non-NFL cities like San Antonio. They've got the Alamo Bowl there already. That's an option. You could even play a game like out in Honolulu, and you could call it like the Pro Bowl Bowl and just, you know, harken back to those old Pro Bowl games played out in Honolulu. There's some interesting things that they could do here. And this is the first like proposal about expanding the schedule that's really got me interested in any way, shape, or form. Hopefully this is not inevitable in the way that jersey ads on NBA jerseys were, but I think it seems like we're headed that way. And if the NFL and the NFLPA are going to expand the schedule, doing it right before the collective bargaining agreement when you're dividing up a bunch of new TV money and streaming money and stuff like that is probably the time that they're going to want to do it. So keep a close eye on this over the next few years. So I've got for you on this episode. Do appreciate listening. Really appreciate everybody who takes the time to download an episode and listen in. If you like what you heard and want to help us keep things going, the best way to support us is leaving a rating or review on iTunes. It does help more people find the show. want to take your support to the next level, the most straightforward way to do that is to donate a buck a month at patreon.com/thepowersweep. That goes a long way towards helping us offset hosting costs for the podcast and for the show and all of those wonderful things. And don't forget to check out our great selection of t-shirts and sweatshirts by clicking the shop link at thepowersweep.com. If you got an idea for the show, or you just want to say hi, or you've got feedback, reach us at thepowersweep.com on Facebook or Twitter, or by emailing thepowersweep1959@gmail.com. As always, every bit of feedback, every message you send helps us make this entire operation better, which furthers our mission of helping everybody become smarter Packers fans. And as I always say, smarter Packers fans are better Packers fans, and better Packers fans are what we all want to be. I'm your host, John Meerdink. We'll see you next time on Blue 58.